I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. LGBTQ rights have been targeted by Republicans, religious groups, and parent organizations in recent months. Florida's parental rights education bill, called the Don't Say Gay bill by its opponents, bans teachers from discussing gender identity and sexual orientation in the lower grades. There are a number of copycat bills in other states. This week on May 8th, Alabama passed the Vulnerable Child Protection Act, which says you could face up to 10 years in prison and a $15,000 fine if you provide gender-affirming care for a person under age 19. Add them all up, and there are well more than 200 anti-LGBTQ bills that have been introduced in state legislatures in this year alone, and it's just May. They are aimed at classrooms and sports and bathrooms, medical care, and families. On a related matter, could overturning Roe v. Wade, which looks likely based on the leaked draft, lead to overturning the Supreme Court decision that legalized same-sex marriage? Well, today on Radio Times, what's behind this wave of legislation, their impact on LGBTQ people, and the legal recourses. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio is Tobias Barrington Wolf. He's Jefferson Barnes Fordham Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Tobias, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty. It's a pleasure to be back in the studio.
Nice to have you back with us and have you in the studio as well. And joining us also is Zane Murib, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Fordham University. Zane Murib, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, we always want to hear from you. There are several ways you can join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We have a lot to discuss. But, Tobias, I do want to begin with the possibility that Roe will be overturned come the end of this semester for the U.S. Supreme Court. Do you think Obergefell, the 2015 decision that legalized same-sex marriage, could be overturned too?
It's entirely possible. Yeah. I mean, one of the most striking and incredibly upsetting things about the draft opinion that Justice Alito wrote is that nowhere in that opinion do women and girls and other people who become pregnant make an appearance. There's no discussion of them as human beings. There's no discussion of their lives and the impact that it would have on them to take this right away from them. And in my view, the most basic responsibility that the Supreme Court has when it's deciding cases that severely impact the lives and the day-to-day existence of people is to take seriously the experience of those people and to explain themselves, explain why it is that they think whatever impact they're going to have on people's day-to-day lives is warranted and required by the Constitution. There's not a hint of that in this draft opinion. And with that, there's a lot of things to be angry about where that's concerned, but part of what that tells me is that this is an extreme majority that is not going to concern itself terribly much with the impact on the lives of real people, at least real people that they are not sympathetic with. And that is that sort of sets up the possibility of some pretty grave impacts for queer and trans people under the Constitution.
Well, and a quick follow-up here, because my understanding with Roe, it's based on privacy and equal protection. And when you talk about Obergefell, marriage equality, based largely on those same principles.
That's right. The primary basis for the marriage equality holding was the fundamental right to marry. And that is a component of the so-called substantive due process liberty interest under the 5th and 14th Amendments to the Constitution. And the origin of that doctrine is Loving versus Virginia, the decision about anti-miscegenation laws and interracial marriage. Now, that holding is not going anywhere because Loving was based primarily on equal protection when it comes to race discrimination and white supremacy. And I don't see this court overturning that holding.
Right.
But the part of Loving that said that there was also a fundamental right to marry that everybody has, and what Obergefell said was same-sex couples partake of that right just like any other couple can. That part of the Loving decision is vulnerable if this awful draft opinion becomes law. And that, in turn, means that Obergefell may be vulnerable as well.
Zane, I'd be curious about your response to the draft and I guess the potential fallout from the draft, certainly when it comes to Obergefell and same-sex marriage.
Yeah, well, I think that One of the things that is interesting is the ways that Obergefell has served as kind of this critical juncture where I think that the people who are mobilizing these anti-LGBTQ bills saw it as like a lost cause, right? That they weren't going to be able to oppose same-sex marriage and this idea of a nuclear family headed by one man and one woman. And so they turned to resisting rights being extended to trans people. And I think that now with same-sex marriage back in play, I'm concerned that there will be more of like an emboldened effort, right, to limit access to even more rights. So one of the, in the leaked draft, there's this line about preserving the integrity of the medical practice, which I think is an interesting and concerning development because it kind of suggests that this isn't just about taking rights away from women to control their bodies, but just people in the general population, right? So I think we see the extension of access to trans healthcare too being even more at risk than it is even now with these bills that are proposing to limit access for young people. We're looking at it now maybe being extended to adults as well.
And I do want to get to all the other bills, but just one quick follow-up. I'll put this to you, Tobias, and this is quoting from Justice Alito. He said, "To ensure that our decision is not misunderstood or mischaracterized, we emphasize that our decision concerns a constitutional right to abortion and no other right. Nothing in this opinion should be understood to cast doubt on precedents that do not concern abortions." Does that give you some confidence that at least this would not be applied to same-sex marriage?
Yeah, that and $6 will buy you a latte at Starbucks.
Okay, so you're not buying it.
No, I mean, first of all, most of the, I think all of the recently appointed members of the majority proclaimed in solemn terms during their confirmation hearings that Roe was settled law. So we see what value that proclamation had. And also, in much more concrete terms, the job of a lower federal court is to apply the precedents of the Supreme Court as they currently exist. And if there's a square holding of the Supreme Court on an issue, a lower federal court is not supposed to take it upon itself to say, well, we don't think that the court would still adhere to that, and so we're not going to recognize that as good law. I see that pronouncement in the draft as serving two functions. The first is to try to limit damage to the Republican Party during the midterms, which is, of course, not what justices of the Supreme Court should be doing, but I think is probably what Justice Alito was doing. Mm. And the second is to signal to lower federal courts that the Supreme Court is the one that's going to overrule cases protecting contraception, cases protecting marriage equality, that the lower federal court shouldn't take it upon themselves to do that. It's really kind of an assertion of their institutional prerogatives. It's not any kind of promise about those precedents not being on the chopping block.
Zane, I said in my introduction about more than 200, I think it's close to 250 anti-LGBTQ bills that have either been passed or in some degree of process in state legislatures across the country. What do you think is driving this?
I think that it is part of a very long project of maintaining conservative and evangelical beliefs about who constitutes not only a proper family, again, headed by one man and one woman, but also who is allowed to be part of social life. So if you look at a lot of the text of these bills, it's very much making it impossible for LGBTQ people to exist in public space. And I also want to be sure to contextualize this more broadly in what's happening in efforts to limit lots of rights for other non-dominant groups. So this includes attacks on protesting. So we've seen in this last legislative session bills being introduced that make it legal for cars to drive into protests. We've also seen a slate of legislation that makes voting more difficult or even impossible for Black, Latinx, Native, and poor people. We're seeing the rolling back of reproductive freedoms more broadly. And then also a lot of attention being paid to critical race theory. And so it's the same people who are pushing these anti-trans laws who are behind these attacks on other rights. And I think that a lot of it is driven by, I think that this has been a project that has been in the works for the last 40 years. But I think that the rightward shift in the courts that Trump and McConnell were really instrumental in bringing about has created an opportunity for these actors to kind of seize the moment and introduce these bills because they know that they won't be they won't face resistance in the courts, or they're banking on that.
I know, Tobias, you want to say something. Let me just toss something out here because of what I find. I'm not sure if interesting is quite the right word, but nonetheless, you've also got growing support among the American public for LGBTQ rights, for same-sex marriage. So on the one hand, and I quoted that from the Public Religion Research Institute, majority support for same-sex marriage, let's say. So are the courts on a collision course with the public?
That's an interesting question. Zane is a political scientist, and so they're going to have a better view on some of these questions than I will. But I think there's a difference between the kind of support it represents when you ask somebody, do they approve of, you know, people having access to certain kinds of rights or benefits, versus whether an issue moves people to make political decisions, make voting decisions, whether it gets people upset and angry. I think the overruling of Roe and Casey, if in fact it happens, may very well operate to the detriment of the right in the United States, because I think the part of the electorate that is not just in support of restrictions on access to abortion, but is highly mobilized by these forced pregnancy laws, right? That's already kind of fully saturated. They've already got the full measure of that core of support has been politically active. I don't think the full measure of the support from people who opposed forced pregnancy laws has been fully motivated, because it's largely, for many people, been notional, right? I mean, there are lots and lots of women and girls and others who get pregnant who have been restricted from access to abortion because of these targeted regulations. But the general populace kind of has it in mind that, well, people have access to abortion. And so it may very well be the case that politically this will be bad news for the right in the United States. But on the issue of marriage equality and other forms of equal rights for queer and trans people, I don't know how much of the polling indicating support is going to translate into the kind of commitment to the issue that will mobilize voters and will mobilize people to action. I just don't know the answer to that.
Well, I do want to pick up on several things that you just said and toss them to you, Zane, but we do need to take a very short break. And we're talking with Tobias Barrington Wolfe. He's a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Also, Zane Murab, their assistant professor of political science at Fordham University. And we're talking about the fact that there are more than 200 anti-LGBTQ bills that have been introduced or passed by state legislatures. You probably heard of some of them, including the one from Florida. It's happening all around us, and we want to understand what is going on, what some of the remedies are, and what some of the impacts are as well. And again, you can always email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. I'm doing too many things here at once. Marty Moscowen, and we're talking about the wave of anti-LGBTQ legislation that is sweeping the country, some of the politics involved, and the impact on LGBTQ people. And again, our guests are Zane Murab and Tobias Barrington Wolfe. I wonder, Zane, if you look at the more than 200 bills, whether they more target trans people than they do the other letters of the alphabet.
Yeah, and I think this connects to what Tobias was talking about just a moment ago with respect to backlash against the courts. One of the things that political science research shows is that with respect to public opinion, people are generally supportive of the extension and maintenance of rights to lesbians and gay men, but that when it comes to transgender people, a lot of people don't even know what transgender means. And it used to be that when this research was done in around 2017, political scientists saw this as an opportunity to say, there should be more education about what it means to be trans, about gender is not this strict binary. But I think what we're seeing now is, on the flip side, it also creates this opportunity for conservative actors to exploit that lack of information about trans people and actually do a lot of fear-mongering, right? And so a lot of the discourse around this is that this is not an authentic identity, it's just a feeling state, that it's, you know, permanent. And again, it really, I mean, you know, at the risk of repeating myself, sure, it's just fear-mongering, right? It's using people's lack of knowledge about a group of people to advance the ball on a political agenda that is very much interested in maintaining heteronormativity or the nuclear family headed by one man and one woman.
Well, a true confession here. I went to the Human Rights Campaign website and I looked up sexual orientation, gender identity, just to make sure that I could use the language correctly. And Tobias, I mean, I think there's clearly hatred and discrimination. And I think there's also confusion, just people trying to figure out, what does this all mean?
Well, I think that's definitely true. But also, I do want to pick up on Zane's very important observations about exploiting a particular moment, right? So parents in the United States have been through hell in the last 2.25 years. They have been having to figure out how to make sure that their kids keep up with their education. They've been having to keep their kids safe. They've been having to keep their households together while they've been trying to stay safe themselves, while their work lives have been disrupted, while a lot of them have been out of work for long periods of time. And one of the things that I think is deeply cynical about the Florida bill and others like it is that it's very clearly exploiting that particular moment in time in which parents feel out of control, right? Part of what these laws do, what they present themselves as doing, is, quote unquote, restoring control to parents. And I think that the political appeal of these laws is that they're exploiting a moment in time in which parents have been stressed and have been at their wits' end and feel out of control in their ability to provide for their kids. And Ron DeSantis comes along and says, I'm going to give you control back. But what does it actually mean, right? What it means is that they're putting the power in the hands of any parent of a child in the Florida public schools to bring crippling lawsuits against their own school district if they don't like the way that sexual orientation or gender identity is discussed in the classroom, or the way in which schools handle difficult questions about kids seeking assistance, bringing sensitive information to the school nurse, to school social workers about developmental questions or about confusion that they're having. Florida is taking this moment in which parents quite legitimately feel out of control and want to restore a sense of balance and control in guiding their kids' education. And they're saying, here's what we're going to do for you. We're going to let you beat up on school districts if sexuality and gender is cropping up in ways that confuse you. It's a terribly exploitative way of treating parents who are legitimately suffering in this difficult moment.
And Zane, looking at the Florida bill, I mean, the language is very vague. So it's sort of, I mean, we all have a gender identity and sexual orientation. Ron DeSantis is quoted as saying parents can be assured that kids will get an education, not an indoctrination. So the language is so sort of convoluted. I mean, the words are not there, but there they are.
Yeah, well, and I think that, you know, with respect to sexual orientation and gender identity, there's a lack of clarity. But I think, and Tobias just said this, that the clearest part of that bill that I find quite stunning is that it says in the first few sentences that it is interested in preserving a parent's fundamental right to control their children, which I agree comes out of this pandemic moment when classrooms moved into people's homes and they suddenly got a peek at the curriculum. But the issue is that this control over children is only if that form of control matches the Florida state's government's vision for child rearing, right? So it's a very particular understanding of rights, where some people have rights to exclude their children from education about sexual orientation and gender identity. But the question then becomes, what about the families who are headed by same-sex couples, right? Or have children who they embrace, who identify as LGBT? I see themselves as kind of painting themselves into a corner with this rights argument in that way.
Well, and I know you want to add something, Tobias. Go ahead.
Yeah, so the Florida law does something which we see this clever trick, or at least they think it's a clever trick, which we see a lot in legislation like this, which is it uses these neutral-sounding terms of sexual orientation and gender identity. And clearly what they mean is queer and trans identity, right? If you're teaching first graders about American history and you tell first graders that George Washington was married to Martha Washington, or that Abraham Lincoln was married to Mary Todd Lincoln, you're talking about their sexual orientation, right? And presumably you're allowed to do that. If you are teaching a civics class to third graders in Florida and you say, let's talk about government, right? Here we are in Florida. Marco Rubio is one of your senators, and here's his story. He's Cuban American. He is married to his wife. They have kids. Isn't this a wonderful story about your senator? And now let's say that you're in one of the U.S. House districts in Florida where your member of the House of Representatives is a gay person. And so then you want to say, and here's your representative, and he's married to his husband, and they have several kids and so forth. I take it that it's quite possible that a parent is going to sue the school district, and they may win. If you talk about your member of the House of Representatives who is gay and who is married to his husband, but apparently it's going to be fine to talk about the fact that Marco Rubio is your senator and he's married to a woman. So either this law is going to be dysfunctional in ways that are hard to imagine,
right?
Or in practice, it's going to mean that one segment of the population, and therefore one segment of the student population, are having their lives erased from the curriculum and indoctrinated into a way of thinking that says they are not allowed to occupy space in public life. And that, if you're interested in talking about constitutional challenges to this law, that's a whole interesting conversation. There are some serious equal protection and equality issues here. You can't, I would venture to say, you can't take one whole population of students and simply erase them and their lives and their family lives from the entirety of the school curriculum.
Well, and Zane, that raises questions and concerns about then the, you know, the mental health of LGBTQ students or students who may have same-sex parents, and their feeling of belonging and acceptance when they're sitting in their, you know, second or third grade classroom.
Yes, and I think that it's been an interesting moment to think about these anti-LGBTQ laws, and also what I think is a lot of attention paid to adolescent suicide lately, which I think is thanks to a New Yorker article that cites that between 2007 and 2017, the number of children aged 10 to 14 who killed themselves more than doubled, which drove the average age of suicide down. And when you think about that alongside research from the Trevor Project, which shows that over half of LGBTQ identified youth in the aggregate have considered suicide, and that transgender boys and girls are even more likely than their non-trans peers to report feeling suicidal. And then even further than that, that suicide attempts are higher for LGBTQ youth of color, I think an extremely troubling picture starts to take shape, because what's happening is these conversations questioning the existence and the legitimacy and the right to live are being discussed in public forums across the gamut, right? It's in the news, it's on social media, and these young people read about how they're talked about. Mm-hmm. So it isn't just about an abstract attack on transgender youth or political calculation that's trying to get votes in the midterms. It's also promoting discourse that advocates for the erasure of these young people. And I find that really concerning, and I don't know that people are talking about that enough.
Yeah, and I mean, that's true for any teenager, but then you add some of the things that you were talking about, Zane, and it becomes an incredible burden to feel so alone in the world. Let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. That's Zane Murib, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Fordham University. Tobias Barrington-Wolf is a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. And again, you can join us Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Tobias, I want to pick up something that Zane said, and this had to do with the Florida law. You both said it, that parents are sort of have the right then to control what their children learn and how their children are raised, that it's the parents' right and responsibility. But then you go to Texas, where a family can be investigated criminally for seeking gender-affirming healthcare treatment for their child. So in Texas, under those circumstances, the parent does not have that kind of authority. Speak to that.
That's right. And you know, Zane put it very well when she talked about erasing, in particular, trans people from public life. And I think that the sort of avalanche of bathroom bills is a great illustration of this. Whenever I have occasion to talk about these hostile bathroom laws for trans people, the question that I always ask proponents of these laws is, what is the solution that you propose? Where should trans people go? Because they talk about where trans people shouldn't go. That's what they're interested in. And so if you ask them, look, is a trans woman who presents as a woman and who in every way relevant to her social existence is a woman, you want her to go into the men's room, right? No is the answer, right? The answer, if you really push them on it, is we want them to go away. We just don't want them to have to deal with them. We just don't want to have them in public life. And this sensibility of erasure of trans people, which also has its own parallel in the historical treatment and in some ways the current treatment of LGBT people as well, is incredibly dangerous. And so you raise this awful policy that's unfolding in Texas. It's enjoined right now. There's a current challenge, but it's not. It's going to be in the hands of the Texas Supreme Court, which I'm not sure what's going to happen there. They are ripping apart families. They are criminally investigating parents for seeking care for their kids, which the overwhelming consensus of the medical community is that it's not only appropriate but vital care for these kids. And Idaho has a proposed law that would do the same thing, and it would also criminalize parents taking their kids out of state to seek this care. It's hard to find the words to describe how upsetting this is. One of my closest friends is a trans rights lawyer, and I've worked with him a great deal on collaborations over many years. And we have been talking about how he should be advising parents in Texas who come to him and say, what should I do? And he has said quite candidly, I don't want to be in the position of telling parents in Texas, get out of Texas if you can. But I think that may be the only responsible advice to give in order to protect these kids. It's that bad.
Zane, do you want to talk about erasure? I mean, what that means, what that feels like?
I think that it's a complicated moment because on one hand, and I also struggle with words to describe this, I mean, I think that it's supremely ironic. I don't know that that's exactly the right word, that the party of small government is now advocating for states to remove children from their parents' care because certain people don't want to recognize that trans people exist. That's the case with this executive order in Texas. But I also, I mean, I don't want to be positive about this moment, but it has been interesting because I think while we're paying a lot of attention to states that are advancing this type of legislation, there's also other states. So for example, New York, New Mexico, Minnesota, Colorado, and California all have bills that have recently been introduced that would provide legal refuge for families from states where anti-LGBTQ laws are passed. And I'll say, on a personal note, I have friends who have trans children, and they live in states where it's more than likely that these bills will be introduced, and they're having conversations now about what they do when that happens, and they're considering moving. And so I think, and that's only available for people who can't afford to do that, who have that mobility. And so I think that in terms of erasure, it's not necessarily a mixed picture that's emerging, but one that is extremely concerning.
Here's Greg. My take is that the litany of nationwide anti-LGBTQ bills seem like something out of Karl Rove's old playbook when the GOP used gay marriage as a wedge issue to whip up their base before the 2004 presidential election. I mean, Tobias, do you see some sort of history repeating itself in a way?
To an extent, Sure. I mean, I think that Karl Rove is the ultimate sort of political cynic who I don't know what the man actually believes and what values actually drive him, but he seems to be willing to exploit whatever issue will allow him to exercise power and allow the people that he's allied with to exercise power. And I certainly think there is some of that going on here. If I thankfully, I also don't personally know Ron DeSantis, but if I had to guess, I would characterize him as kind of an empty suit when it comes to values and just somebody who will exploit whatever issue will allow him to exercise power. I do also think, though, that there is a through line here relating to sex and gender and sexual orientation and sexuality. And it unites the what appears to be the era of forced pregnancy laws that are coming.
The anti-abortion laws.
The anti-abortion and forced pregnancy laws, exactly. The assault on access to contraception, which is being queued up in various states. The assault on queer youth and the assault on trans youth, which is that sex and gender and sexuality are places of vulnerability and places of very sort of deep personal feeling and connection for just about everybody. And I think that there is a desire. I mean, this is a word that often gets used in academic circles, but I think we need to start talking about it. There's a desire to promote patriarchy here, right? To promote a view that says that the straight male human is and should be at the top, at the apex of the pyramid of power, and that laws that seek to control sex and sexuality and gender are tools that are used to reinforce that exercise of power by a patriarchal structure. And I think we need to start using that kind of language.
We're almost up in a break here. Is punishment, I mean, is that also a word we should use, that people are being punished for their behavior or their identity?
Good heavens, yes. I mean, you know, forced pregnancy laws are going to criminalize doctors and pregnant people for seeking to control their own reproductive lives. Alabama and Texas are criminalizing parents for seeking appropriate care for their trans kids. Punishment is the tool they are using.
And that is Tobias Barrington Wolf, also with us, Zane Murib. And we do want to hear from you. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org and tweet us, WHYY Radio Times, or call us 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Zane Murib and Tobias Barrington Wolf about the wave of anti-LGBTQ legislation that's sweeping the country, including Florida's so-called Don't Say Gay bill. Also talking about discrimination against transgender students and gender-affirming health care. Let me read an email from Colleen, and Zane, I'll put it to you. Colleen says, I'm a therapist in the Philadelphia area, work with a lot of LGBTQIA plus people, and I share some of the identities myself. For LGBTQ plus people, access is already quite difficult. People face insurance boundaries, struggles to find provider who is informed, supportive, and positive, cost, time from work, etc., not even including the interpersonal backlash. Data shows that healthcare, especially gender-affirming healthcare, massively improves the well-being of LGBTQ people. And just to underscore that, Zane, but anything you want to add back to Colleen's comment there?
Yes. So the American Association of Pediatrics says that this form of care for trans youth is life-saving care. And this goes back to some of the points that I was raising earlier about just how this erasure is a threat to young people. But there's a couple things that I wanted to return to that
sure.
Tobias was talking about. I really want to underscore that this phrase that he's using, which is forced pregnancy, which I think is very different from the ways that we've talked about access to abortion in the past, because that's what these laws are doing, right? They're compelling people to carry pregnancies to term that would not or should not or cannot carry those pregnancies to term. But the other term that I wanted to return to is patriarchy, mm-hmm. And add another one to it and talk about white supremacy. And here I'm not talking about, you know, black versus white racism or thinking about it in this way, but rather the laws and institutions that ensure that white people always get what they want and need without really having to think about it, but then more importantly, at the expense of marking an explicit outsider. And I think that's what these bills are doing. And I, you know, I spoke earlier about the broader context, that this is also alongside attacks on critical race theory, limiting voting rights for Black, Latinx, and Native people. And so I just want to make sure that we're clear that, like, it is about patriarchy, but it's also about marking who belongs in the fabric of American society. And whenever you make a claim that some people belong, it requires setting people outside. And that's what we're seeing now.
I appreciate you adding that. And let me just pick up on that. I'll put this to you, Tobias. Are we seeing, especially focused on schools, is this an organized effort, a nationwide effort to, or even some of these legislatures? Or is this sort of individual responses to something that's going on? You talked about parents, but I wonder, mm-hmm. is someone organizing all this?
Sure. So I think it's actually a really interesting and important question, how much of this is a grand organized conspiracy, right? And look, there are very influential organizations that draft proposed legislation and then work with very conservative members of state legislatures and state executives to get them implemented. And that's a reality. And it used to be an organization called ALEC, and I think ALEC is less influential than they used to be, but there is a fundamentalist organization, the name of which is escaping me, which I think is
Moms for Liberty?
That's not the one I'm thinking of, but anyway.
Alliance Defending Freedom?
Alliance Defending Freedom is a legal advocacy organization, which I've squared off against on a couple of occasions. But when it comes to drafting proposed legislation, that is a real phenomenon. And that's why you see so many of these bills rolled out very quickly in many different states. But also, I think there is an element of this which is a kind of organic, there are forces at work that are ready to be mobilized. And I'm very glad that Zane introduced white supremacy into the conversation. It was one of the topics I was going to embark on as well. Let's talk about this in very concrete terms, right? In addition to these laws erasing gay and trans people from our schools, we have these laws erasing the so-called 1619 Project, critical race theory, whatever people think they're talking about when they invoke those terms, erasing the reality of the history of race relations from the United States, taking the position that we can't make children uncomfortable by talking about difficult realities of race. Well, as many people have observed, this is far from original to me. When you set policy erasing one whole group of people, one whole group of children, in this case non-white children, from the history that you're willing to tell because you don't want to make some children uncomfortable, you're saying a lot about whose comfort matters and whose well-being in the schools matters. And I think that, I mean, it is well known that access to abortion and the impact of forced pregnancy laws falls more heavily on women and girls of color and on women and girls who have not only less access to resources, less access to jobs that allow them to take time off from work if they need to do that to get an abortion, less access to quality health care, which is a product not just of money but also of residential segregation and longstanding patterns of residential segregation. When it comes to violence against trans people, violence happens in many different settings. The single group that is most vulnerable to violence in the United States today in the trans community is trans and women and girls of color, particularly Black trans women and girls, but also Latino and Asian and Native trans women and girls. There are stories to tell in each of these settings about the impact not just of sex and gender, but of race on who is vulnerable, who matters, and who is taken into account. And that is, you know, part of what is so hard and challenging but also important about this moment is that we, in some sense, we always need to be talking about all of that at once because it is always all on the table. And I think that...
And connected, you're saying.
Exactly correct. And I think part of what you see is efforts to segment populations and isolate populations and mobilize sort of hostile legislation and policies against one group at a time, right? And make it more difficult politically and otherwise for all of those people to organize and resist.
Let me read a couple of comments, and then, Zane, I'll turn to you. Thomas says, has anyone talked to the students about their take on this? With all the noise about this, students are learning more on the news on this topic than in the classroom. I'll just kind of leave that out there. A comment from Conrad, I could not agree more that more education is absolutely necessary, that would help reduce people being confused and reacting negatively out of a misunderstanding. Richard said the GOP is close to, if not already, a minority party intent on holding on to power, ginning up resentment of any kind. And then I'll get to some of the other questions there. But let me turn to you, Zane. And President Biden hosted Transgender Visibility Day. I think it was last week or certainly within the last week or two. How important is that, you think, in the big scheme of things?
I think that it's absolutely always important to be attentive to visibility and make sure that people feel as though they're seen. I want to make sure in those projects that it's always as wide a range as possible. I think to Tobias's point about who's particularly vulnerable in this moment. But moving to the schools, I'm just thinking about how I was recently in Florida and I was passing a high school, and I actually couldn't believe the degree to which it was festooned in rainbows. I mean, there were like rainbow flags everywhere. There was a rainbow crosswalk. There were statements of affirmation. And so I am reassured that, or I think that that is something that I would want to say, which is this is also up to young people to resist and say, these laws are being made in our names to protect us and we don't want them. This is all a charade. It's an effort to get votes. And I think it's inspiring to see when students speak up in those ways.
Well, in fact, here in Central Bucks at the Lenape Middle School, some of the students there are protesting their outrage because there was a teacher there who got suspended for, and I'm quoting here, giving a bully transgender student information on harassment resources outside of the district. Now, the school says that's not why they were suspended. But nonetheless, you've got young people with flags, Tobias, out on the street rallying for a teacher.
One of the steps that the Biden administration took recently is to make internet access available either for free or on an affordable basis for low-income Americans around the United States. And that is a step that's going to have massive implications in a whole lot of ways when it comes to access to work, when it comes to access to the vote and the ability to educate oneself about how to register and how to vote, and also when it comes to young people's access to information. Let me be clear. It is not an adequate solution to say that if kids are being abused in various ways in their school, they can turn to their own resources and find information and find community online. That is not an adequate answer to these appalling laws. But it is a reality that right now, the ability of young people in the United States to get access to information on their own terms is probably the greatest it's ever been in human history. And
they know how to do this.
They know how. They certainly know how to look for information and community on their own terms. They also are subject to lots of forms of manipulation and exploitation online. There's a lot to say about the wilderness, which is the online world for young people, including TikTok. But I think that part of what we are going to see, which is at least has opportunities for inspiration, is young people resisting these forms of restrictive laws and forming community on their own terms in ways that are going to teach the rest of us and are going to represent a next generation of leadership. And they shouldn't have to be doing that work under fire in the way that they are, but they are going to be doing that work under fire. And I'm ready to take some direction from young people, frankly, about how they're forming community and what they need from the rest of us.
Here's an email question from Laura. Zane, I'll put it to you. What I wonder is where are the doctors suing to defend their prerogative to do no harm, both in terms of being prohibited from performing abortions when appropriate and also treating transgender children? Could that be grounds for a suit? I realize the lawyer is sitting across from me, Zane, but it seems like there are opportunities to, if not legally, in other ways, to, in a sense, fight back.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a better question for a lawyer. But I will say that It will be interesting to see the ways that interest groups respond to these limitations on what doctors can and cannot do. And I mean, the American Medical Association is a very powerful and well-resourced interest group. And I'll be curious to see maybe signing on to an amicus brief or things like this. But it'll be interesting to see what they do in response.
And is there a legal recourse here, Tobias?
Yeah, it is often doctors and medical professionals who are among the vanguard of people challenging these kinds of appalling laws. So, for example, in Alabama, a law has just taken effect that criminalizes providing medically appropriate care to minors to help them confirm their gender identity. And there is litigation in federal court right now, and some of the plaintiffs are care providers who, by the way, are asking to proceed anonymously because they fear violence and harm from their community if they're identified as people who provide this care to young people. And they also fear that it will expose young people to harm if people know that these care providers are serving them. You know, it is often care providers in cases involving abortion and forced pregnancy laws that are bringing these lawsuits. But let's also not fail to recognize how under fire doctors are going to be. I talked about the extraordinary stresses that parents have been experiencing in the last 2.25 years. Doctors and medical professionals have been stressed to the limit for the last 2.25 years, beyond anything that could reasonably be expected of them. Many of them both going the extra mile to provide care in this pandemic and also encountering hostility for doing exactly that from pandemic deniers and who knows what else. There are laws now on the books or being proposed in the anticipation of Roe being overruled that define life as beginning at the moment of fertilization, not implantation, and define it as murder to destroy a fertilized egg, right? So never mind what that means for IVF and assisted reproductive technologies. What about a doctor who needs to treat an ectopic pregnancy, right? Now, many of these states in one way or another presumably will have pathways that will allow doctors to treat that kind of medical emergency. But if you're a doctor and every time a patient presents with a life-threatening ectopic pregnancy, you need to seek advice to make sure that you're not going to be subject to a felony prosecution for providing that care, it's insanity. Mm. It is insanity.
Well, we're almost out of time here. And Zane, I just want to put the final question to you. Is it any coincidence that this is an election year, and the same year that we're seeing more than 200 anti-LGBTQ bills in legislatures? And we know how close things are in the U.S. Congress, but I'm also thinking about legislatures across the state. Is this, should we be surprised about that?
I think the short answer is no. I think that this is a very pragmatic approach by the Republican Party that sees itself as kind of waning in popularity and, again, exploiting lack of information. Yeah, that's the short answer in my view.
Well, do you want to give me a short answer to Tobias?
I'll just say, returning to a point we made earlier, I think that to the extent that this is motivated by an attempt to seize more power and more political control, I think it is a very dangerous high-stakes tactic that the right is employing, and I think it may backfire on them. I think that there are a lot of forces at work, gerrymandering, the gutting of the Voting Rights Act, the takeover of state election official positions by extremists who think that the 2020 election was rigged. There are a lot of challenges to democracy right now. And the reason for that is that the right is finally beginning to mobilize the kind of response from centrist Americans who are appalled by these laws and who see them finally starting to affect them personally. And so if this is a political tactic, I think it's a very high-stakes risk.
Well, we'll find out. Tobias Barrington-Wolf, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Zane Murab, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Tobias Barrington-Wolf is a professor of law, University of Pennsylvania Law School. Zane Murab, assistant professor of political science at Fordham University. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. And as always, you can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us.